Craftsman Days are here at Lowe's with big savings on the tools you need. Right now, get a free select tool when you buy the Craftsman V20 2-Pack Battery Kit. Whether it's the backyard, the bathroom, or beyond, Craftsman has the tools to help you power through and get the project done right. Because DIYing is unpredictable, but your tools shouldn't be. Shop Craftsman at Lowe's today. Valid through 6/18 while supplies last. Selection varies by location.
Reincarnation with extraordinary documentation. Jeffrey Keane.
He was hit with a saber, or he was hit with a bullet ricocheted off his forehead outside Shepherdstown, Virginia, which at that time might have been West Virginia, because West Virginia split from Virginia. That you can actually see in the proof positive program, which is still online. There's videos of it, where a doctor overlays my picture, my sort of a negative of my face on a negative of Gordon's face, and that mark on my forehead matches up exactly where Gordon was wounded.
Jeffrey Keane, retired 2003 as Assistant Fire Chief, Westport, Connecticut Fire Department. He spent the last 15 years as a shift commander, was charged with the development and implementation of standard operation procedures for the department. That's the backstory. He was also filmed for his past life experience in the A&E documentary Beyond Death, which aired April 2001. He was featured in Another Life that aired in 2003. And he tells his story of reincarnation at the gravesite of Confederate General John B. Gordon at Oakland Cemetery in Atlanta, Georgia. You might have seen shows about him, a couple of them hosted by William Shatner, Weird or What and The Unexplained. And the one that does a really nice wrap-up is featured on his website. It's from the Sci-Fi Channel Proof Positive, and that aired in November 2004. The book, Fire in the Soul. Now, he's written another book called Someone Else's Yesterday. Same topic, only the recent one has a little bit more background. And if you're interested in reincarnation and you've been looking for a story that's a slam dunk, this is it. The backstory, the coincidences, the synchronicity is absolutely astounding. So, Jeffrey, you have an incredible story.
People tell me I have a fascinating story, and I said, yes, it fascinates me, and it has been fascinating me for decades now. A lot of people ask me how it all started, and I tell them my story starts in the middle. And they say, the middle? I said, yeah, in the middle of an old sunken road on a battlefield at Antietam. And I hadn't been a student of the Civil War, or never read a book on the Civil War, had very little taught about it in school. I had seen some of the Ken Burns series and was very impressed on what a great job he had done telling the soldier stories and so on. My wife and I were in heat hunting down in Pennsylvania. We were headed down toward Maryland, and we weren't too far from Antietam Battlefield. And people that don't know the Battle of Antietam, they should, because it's still is the bloodiest day in the history of the United States. There was more people killed, wounded, and missing. An 11-hour battle, I think it was around 25,000 killed, wounded, and missing. So it wasn't exactly a stroll in a park. I felt compelled. I wanted to go over that way. I asked my wife if it was all right. We'd take a little side trip. And we drove over to the battlefield, and the battle consisted of three separate battles almost. One was the cornfield, another was the sunken road, and another was Burnside Bridge. So we went to we were going right in order, went to the cornfield, that section, and my wife and I walked around, and she shortly went back to the car and sat in the car, and that was the end of her history tour. Drove to the next portion, which was the sunken road, and it's named that because it was worn down farm road from all the travel of the wagons up and down. And actually, one portion it made like a trench. So it was a good portion of the battlefield for some of the soldiers to take refuge in, knowing they were going to be shot at. It's nice to have a ditch to dive into. So I left my wife in the car, walked over to the sunken road. There was a tape recording that was sort of like Alice in Wonderland with the bottle and the cookie, you know, eat me and drink me and stuff. It said push, so I pushed it, and it told a little bit about what happened in that portion of the battlefield. I walked down into the road itself, made a left-hand turn, and walked about, 25 yards or so, and was struck with, it's very hard to explain, an anxiety reaction, I guess you would call it. I was having a hard time breathing. I was all kinds of emotions going through me. I was angry. I was sad. It was amazing, the bravery of what the guys did there that day, and so on. And I was crying, and I didn't know what. I didn't know if I was having a heart attack or what. I didn't have any pain or anything, but I actually physically crawled up out of that roadway, straightened myself up somewhat, went back to the car, didn't say anything to my wife because how was I going to explain it to her? I didn't know what happened myself. Drove over to Burnside's Bridge, got out of the car, went over to the bridge, and just gathered myself together a little more. And that was it. Went back to the car. Never said anything to my wife. And on the way out of the area, we stopped at a gift store, and there was a saw this magazine, Civil War Quarterly, Antietam edition, and picked it up, threw it on the counter. My wife was cashing out, and I said, I want this. So then we went home, and I took that magazine, and I put it in with the phone books. That's back when people had phone books.
Yeah.
Now we skip to a little time warp here. A year and a half later, my wife and I went to her friend's birthday party. She just happened to be born on Halloween, and her boy was for her husband, just happened to be born on Halloween, and they rented a restaurant and did all the decorations and everything. The woman hired a cartoonist to do caricatures and a palm reader. So my wife and I went through the line to have a cartoon done, and it was right next to where the palm reader was, and I had never seen a palm reader, psychic, anybody like that. So I was watching her as I went through the line and listened to what she said to people. And she seemed very sincere and a nice lady. And so we had the cartoon done. And after dinner, I said, my wife, I'm going to go over and see the palm reader. She said, I'm going too. So my wife was behind me in line. And just before I got to the palm reader, I said to my wife, I said, watch when she gets to me. And my wife says, why? I said, I don't know. So I sat down in front of this woman, and she picked up my hand. And I had watched her with other people. She had like a little pen light and was looking at the lines and everything. And she said, this is only the second time I've ever seen that. I said, I washed my hands, you know. She said, no, the simian line that crosses the palm. I think it's supposed to be like one of the first lines to develop in your hand. I said, simian like monkey? She says, yes. She says, yours goes right across and almost down the other side. She said, I only know one other person that has one that long. I said, oh. Forgot to ask her what that meant, but we went on, and she, looking at my hands, she dropped them, and she said, you know things. You know stuff. She said, you're intelligent. You're very intelligent. Well, I'm not going to argue with this woman. I said, oh, okay. And she picks up my hands again. She says, you know about doors and things opening and closing. And I said, well, I've had some strange things happen. She says, well, like what? So I told her what happened at the sunken road. And she's nodding her head. And she says, that's because you died there. I said, oh, good. She said, but you were hovering over your body, and you were very angry, and you yelled no. And for some reason, I said to her, not yet. And she says, yes, like not yet. So there was other people waiting, and a few more things talking about, and then went back to the table. Then I went, told my wife, I'm going through the line again. So I went up, waited through this big line. She was very popular. We waited for this big line, sat down in front of her, and she said, oh, honey, I've taken you as far as I can go. I said, let me ask you two questions. The first one was, are you sure the soldier was dead? She said, oh, there was holes all through him and everything. Then I asked her about something that happened in Florida. Well, the next day, I took my wife to work. I go back home. I'm sitting home, and I remember the magazine. Had to have it, threw it on the counter, took it home, put it with my phone books. The only magazine I ever put one of my phone books. Everybody knew where the phone books were back then. So anytime I wanted to see it in that time period, I could have gone and picked it up. So I figured now's the time to pick it up. So I get it. I open it up to the portion on the sunken road. And I read down the page, or I was just given down the page, and there's a two-word quote. It says, not yet. Now the hair stands up on the back of my neck. So I go back up and I read a little more. And that quote came from a colonel, John B. Gordon. It was with the 6th Alabama. And they were in the sunken road, and his men were getting antsy, wanted to open fire, and he yelled, no, not yet. He kept out, tell them, not yet, wait for orders from the center and everything. Sort of like the Bunker Hill with wait till they see the whites of their eyes type thing. Mm-hmm. So I read a little farther. He was wounded 5 times that day. He was shot in the right leg twice, in the left arm, the left shoulder, and the last round that took him out of action hit him in the under his left eye, went through his face and busted his jaw, almost severed his jugular, and that put him out of commission. So I said, that must be the one that finished him off. And I look on the page next to the one I'm reading, and there's a portrait picture, almost full figure, of a General John B. Gordon. I said, wait a minute. He's a colonel in the story. He's a general in the picture. He lived. And then I looked at the face, and I told people I know the face very well. I shave it every morning.
See, that's what's amazing, because when you see these pictures of you side by side, it's just extraordinary. It's a twin.
Robert Stack used to do Unsolved Mysteries. Mm-hmm. That company started up another one called Proof Positive. They called me on the phone and wanted me to come and be on this program. And I said, what's the name of the program? They said, Proof Positive. I said, well, that's a rather ambitious title, because if you were going to do something on the Loch Ness Monster, people are going to want to see you go in there, grab them by the neck and pull them out. But they probably did the best on my story of anybody that ever in TV or anywhere else that ever did. I spent 6 days with them. We went back to Antietam. They had gave me a physical exam. They had a facial recognition expert check the photos between Gordon and myself, and a 3-hour lie detector test, which I'll never do again because it's not pleasant. Even if you don't have anything to hide, it's not pleasant, trust me.
Wow.
Needless to say, there was three different stories, and needless to say, they spent so much time and money and stuff. My mind was the Proof Positive one, because they came up with so much evidence, visual evidence and everything. Yeah, they worked me over pretty good. But
well, you have birthmarks and battle wound type correlations, so this isn't there's a lot there to unpack.
These things came in spurts, and what happened was I had a photo of Gordon that I wanted a copy. And I went to the camera shop, whatever, they had one of those machines you can make enlargements. And there was a man working on it. He said, oh, did you want to use the machine? He says, it's all finished. He says, is that the picture you want? He says, you mind if I do something? He says, I want to try the development stuff or something in all the different sizes. So he printed out all these different sizes. And one of them was Gordon's full face enlarged. And I thanked him. You know, they just charged me for the one enlargement.
Yeah.
And I went home, and I was looking at Gordon's face, and I went in and stood in front of the mirror and looked and turned sideways. Gordon has a lightning streak type scar that ran from his ear down to his chin. They kind of put him back together, and at one period in his life, he looked a little bit like a patchwork quilt, because there was so much damage done to his face. He had a deep rent where the bullet went in on the left side, but the right side had all been blown apart. For anybody that knows ballistics, the bullet does more damage coming out than it does going in, because mm-hmm. it's expanded and everything. I had the photo in my hand. I'm looking at the mark on his face, and I'm looking in the mirror, and I'm going, no, it doesn't stand out very much, but it's there, and it's noticeable, and it actually shows up in photos. If you see photos of me online with my fire helmet on and stuff, you can see the mark that I'm talking about. Well, that's just one mark. So I figured, now, wait a minute. He wrote a book. He survived. He wrote a book, Reminiscences of the Civil War, and he described his wounding in Antietam. He said the first round hit him in the right calf, but didn't hit a bone or anything. Then he said he was hit higher up in the same leg. Then he said he was shot in the left arm and it tore up some tendons. And he was hit in the left shoulder with a spent bullet, which means it didn't really penetrate too much. Most of the power was out of it. It was like getting hit with a rock that somebody threw very, very hard. And then the round that went through his face. Men don't usually suffer from varicose veins. For some reason, women seem to get them in their legs a lot more than men do. I only have two of them. And the only place I have them is I have one on my right calf and then higher up on the same leg. My left arm, I went to a doctor one time and had a blood clot removed. I said, what's that from, doc? He says, oh, they just happen. I said, okay. I also have a marking on my forehead where he was wounded he was hit with a saber or he was hit with a bullet ricocheted off his forehead. And outside Shepherdtown, Virginia, which at that time might have been West Virginia, because West Virginia is split from Virginia. That you can actually see in the proof positive program, which is still online. There's videos of it, where a doctor overlays my sort of a negative of my face on a negative of Gordon's face, and that mark on my forehead matches up exactly where Gordon was wounded. So I've got markings all over the place, the same place as he was wounded during Civil War.
Well, and your website, jeffreykeen.com, you also have the segment of proof positive, 13 minutes or so, and really gives a good idea of your whole story.
It's on the bottom of the homepage.
Yeah.
Now, the icing on the cake for that one was back when I was 30 years old, exactly 30, because I went with my brother and some friends from the fire department down to VFW. And at midnight became September 9th and my 30th birthday. So we're leaving, and I got such a pain in my face and my jaw and my shoulder that I told my brother, I'd been through medical training. I was in the medics in the Air Force. And I knew you could have a heart attack without having the chest pains. It could be referred pain to go other places. It hurt so much. I could take a lot of pain. I told my brother, I said, get me over to the emergency room. Went over to the emergency room. They did EKGs. The doctors looked at me, all kinds of chest x-rays, this and that, and could find nothing wrong. And a few hours later, pain subsided, went away, and it was gone. Now, somebody say, hey, how'd you enjoy your 30th birthday? Yeah, I spent it over at the emergency room. Not too pleasant. Now, that was back when I was 30 years old. The incident that happened at the Sunken Road was 1991. I was in my early 40s, okay? So that pain that I felt on my 30th birthday was the wound, mimicked the wound at Gordon when he was shot through the face at Antietam. It was a decade before that hospital trip happened. That was a decade before I had even heard his name. So it wasn't like, a lot of people like to work my story backwards. They say, oh, he saw a picture of a guy, looked like him, and then he worked all these things into it. No, many of these things and the hospital visit were way before I even knew anything about Gordon. Gordon, when he was wounded at Sunken Road, he was born in 1832, and the Battle of Antietam was fought in 1862. And I'm terrible at math, but he was 30 years old when he was shot through the face.
Bingo. Another connection.
Yeah.
When you first started connecting these dots, and you're beginning to see that these things actually are adding up, how did your wife, your mom, how did your relatives respond? Because as you said before, this wasn't something you were already, you know, you didn't necessarily believe any of it.
Okay, now let's see. My mother was the only person that ever told me to my face, she said, Jeff, you're nuts.
To your face, oh, that says something.
and I said, thanks, Mom. Mm-hmm. Now, I didn't bother people with my story. My wife saw some of the stuff that was going on and happening. I had mentioned that Gordon wrote a book. I went and got that out of the library and read just a portion. I didn't take it out of the library. I went to the library, read it, and just a portion on Antietam, and put it back because I didn't want to be affected by the other stuff in the book.
Yeah.
But now I come home and I see there was a book written about Gordon. I was looking into it, and on the very first page it said he was born in Upson County, Georgia, and at a young age moved with his family to the northwest section of Georgia outside of small town Lafayette. I put the book down. I picked up the phone. I called my mother. Now, my mother was a recent widow, and my mother had lived in Florida, and my father passed away, and she stayed in the house a little while, and then, like a lot of widows do, they end up moving somewhere else. She decided to move in with my sister, South Main Street, Lafayette, Georgia, the town where Gordon grew up. So I called her up. I said, Mom, you have anything down there named after any Gordons? She said, oh, yeah, there's Gordon Hall, where he went to school. There's Gordon this, there's Gordon that. But she was going to come up for the summers, but I went down and I picked her up. And she was with me quite a few times when other little epiphanies and synchronicities and things like that would happen. So my wife was aware of some of the story and the goings-on. The first real mention of my story, I was on the front page of the Connecticut Post back in June of 1994.
I like the way you address that, because when you agreed to do the interview and then you said, okay, what page? And you said, well, the front page. You said, well, which page is that? You weren't expecting,
yeah.
I think, the way that they made it headline news.
No, he said there's only one front page. But I'm a little mad at him because I told him to make sure that there wasn't any past life regression mentioned in that, because I never had it done and I didn't want to have that in there.
Yeah.
And he mentioned past life regression with Jean Loomis, a woman that taught me how to meditate one day for about an hour, and I went home and I did so well by myself I didn't need any past life regressions. So now the reporter had talked to me, and then when I was at work, he had talked to my wife and got her comments and everything. And so when I went home, I said, you talked to the reporter? She said, yeah. I said, what'd you tell him? She said, you can read it in the newspaper. She wouldn't tell me. And I never asked her thoughts on the whole thing. But the thing was, she said that there were so many things, odd things that happened that lined up in dates and places and people, and that she believed there was something to it.
Yeah. And that's the first you learned of it.
Pardon?
That's the first that you learned that she was supportive.
Oh,
basically.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I had to read about what my wife thought in the newspaper.
That's what keeps relationships interesting. Okay. You can't have the whole book, open book. There's so much of your backstory with all of the synchronicity. And then when I'm in the book, The Fire in the Soul, there's other correlations with the people that you work with the other firefighters.
Well, that people that didn't care for my first book, didn't care for my story, the thing that they were saying that they didn't like about my story was that I was saying that these people that I work with were people that I was with in the Civil War. And that's not true. People read the book carefully, they'll see that as I went through different museums and stuff like that, I came across photos that look like some of the men that I worked with. And even when I looked at the personalities of those people from the past, they kind of matched up a little bit. And all I did was I got permission from a few of the guys. I said, would you mind if I used your picture and their picture? I won't say anything about whether you believe in reincarnation or what you feel about it. I just showed them like comparison side by side and saying, isn't this interesting?
Yeah.
It seems like there might be something to it. Now, Wayne Zaletta, there's a picture of Wayne Zaletta, and he looked a lot like Cadmus Wilcox, Union General. He even has the same markings on his face in the photos. Isn't the general's, the mark on their face matches up perfectly. a lot of people were saying, no, it's not just him. Now it's everybody around him and all that. Well, there's another way you can look at that. The Gordon portion of my story kind of convinced me that there was something to it.
Yeah.
And as soon as you open the door for one past life, where do you stop? You open it up for another 100 or 1,000 lifetimes? Or
I want to go back real quick. In the book, The Man You're Talking About, page 198, the thing that I find interesting is that, you believe it or not, that he has a handlebar-type mustache in the present-day photo, and then in the past history photo, he has a very similar style. That's incredibly coincidental.
Now, if you look at the other two gentlemen, the photos I found of the other lifetimes, the Civil War lifetimes, that's, they're striking the same pose.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Yeah. The mannerisms.
Yeah. And those weren't staged. One of them's up on top of a mountain. They climbed a mountain or something. But they're actually standing this, like, it's like the same poses. It almost looks like a setup, but it's not.
You also continue to find out more about your own past lives.
Yeah, more and more. I went down to Lafayette when I went to pick up my mother. I went to, I told you, synchronicities and stuff like that. I went to pick up my nephew at school. And, I kind of invited myself. I heard the next day that they were going to do a tour of Gordon Hall, which wasn't open to the public. And it was where John Gordon went to school. And it was where Braxton Bragg mapped out the Battle of Chickamauga in the front yard, a historical building. So I kind of went to my nephew's school, and he went over and asked the teacher if his uncle could come along with them. The teacher was very nice. Oh, yeah, you could tag along with us. We're not going to be down there for a while, so why don't you go down to the school? We'll meet you down there. So I went down to the school. Now, a man from the Chamber of Commerce was there, and he had opened the door. He said, are you with the tour? I said, well, kind of, but not really. I said, I'm supposed to be meeting him here. He says, would you watch the place for me? You know, he didn't want to leave it unattended. So he said, will you watch this? I said, sure. So here I used to go around, look in the windows, jump up and down, look in windows. Now all of a sudden I'm in charge of the place. And the glass came down. I told my nephew, Mom, on the story of your uncle's reincarnation. Don't say anything. I said, you could say that I know a little bit about General Gordon's life and all that. Ended up, when they were finished at the school, the teacher asked me if I could speak to the children. Now I'm out alongside the school underneath this old oak tree with limbs on it that are about 60 feet long, telling about John Gordon's lifetime and everything. So you never know where you're going until you get there.
Jeffrey Keane, he mentions meditation. What we don't get into, and what I spoke with him about a little bit, he said when he meditated, he'd often go for 6 hours. That's an intense meditation. The other thing that happened was he increased his PSI psychic abilities, and that was a little bit too much. He said you become really empathic, and so you take on everybody else's stuff. That's another thing that comes along with meditation, some of the increase in these other intuitive abilities, and sometimes it can be overwhelming. I just wanted to reference the meditation isn't just your simple sit-down 20-minute meditation. These are intense meditations, and why he was able to tap into some of his reincarnation memories. A quick break, Jeffrey Keane, Fire in the Soul. Jeffrey Keane, we can't get everything in this interview. Check Reincarnation Research for his story. Also his website, jeffreykeane.com, Fire in the Soul.
The fact that you were able to already have had your own past history and had a chance to kind of reconcile that, people were asking for your help and your insight. This little boy was having these incredible memories of 9/11.
Carol Bowman has a reincarnation forum. It was mainly for children. She did a few books on children's past lives and so on. And I knew Carol traveling the country with Dr. Sim Q, travel around, and she would be at some of the same lectures and all that. And I would go on her forum once in a while to see what was going on. People would ask me questions about my story and so on. But I stayed off of it mostly, but every once in a while, one of the moderators would get a hold of me, email, say, Jeff, maybe you can help this person with this question and so on. I've done it over the years. She called me in, and there was a woman in California who had a son that was born in 2003 in October. She said he started talking around 2.5. He started saying that he was a firefighter, not that he wanted to be a firefighter. And I found it odd that he used the phrase firefighter, because a lot of times kids will say fireman, which is not proper. Firefighter is the correct terminology. And he would also tell her that he was fire rescue, which made some bells go off in my head, because that's a phrase you wouldn't expect to hear from somebody who's 2.5, 3 years old. She wrote a few things that he had said and things that he had done and everything. And I've been in fire rescue for 35 years, and I set up the standard operating procedures for the department in Westport, Connecticut. One of the things he mentioned was when the bucket comes down and the bucket truck, and when it gets down the bottom, there's a bounce. There were so many things that it wasn't like, you know, the trucks are red and the trucks make a lot of, it was little nuances, little tiny things. I said the only way anybody could know about that was if they had been a firefighter and actually been through what he was talking about.
And he had numbers, too. He kept repeating numbers.
He kept repeating numbers, mainly the number 3. His mother said it was either 3 or 33, and he had a 3 or 33 on his helmet. Now, this is a small child, and she's trying to, you know, and it's sort of like having a speech impairment when you're learning how to talk. You know, sometimes the words don't come out right, but she was putting all this stuff together. From the stories that he was telling, and it was like different fires and different, he was talking about different apparatus and things, and even where his firehouse was, it was, he said it was downtown. I said, oh my goodness. Downtown is a phrase they use in Manhattan for the lower section of Manhattan. And the way he was talking, I said he had to be either a lieutenant or a captain to be riding in the front seat of one of the rigs. I would give his mother little, you don't want to feed things into a child, but you could also catch him in off times. And I said he was either a lieutenant or captain. I said sometime just, you know, see if you could work some of these things in a conversation. She said he was in the tub one time and he's playing with the little fire engines and all that. He was talking about the engine and in the front, that was where he sat. She said, oh, were you the captain? No. She said, you must have been the Lou. Lou is what a lot of guys use at the fire department. Short for instead of yelling lieutenant all the time, they go, hey, Lou. She said, yeah, you must have been the Lou. She said, he snapped around to her. He says, how did you know?
Yeah.
And he gave so much detail that tracked it down, and it kept narrowing it down more and more. And it turned out we tracked down, he was telling the life story of a lieutenant that had been on Ladder 3 and had perished 9/11 in the North Tower. He was born 2003. That's a pretty fast comeback from 9/11.
Yeah, real quick turnaround.
The thing was, this was all happening back in 2007 with the back and forth on the forum. Now, the mother wanted to say a lot of things. She didn't want to put them on the forum. So there was a lot of it that was discussed between the two of us off the forum. We had tracked down who his parents had been, his parents were and everything. At that time, they were living, and she didn't really want to get involved with, you know, getting involved with his family, the lieutenant's family, which is a good thing because they were strict Catholic and so on. She didn't want to mess up other people's lives, so we stayed quiet on all of it. And then now when I was putting out the new book, Fire in the Soul, I was doing a rewrite or an update of someone else's yesterday. So I did my story again and then added another portion of things that had happened to me since the writing of the first book, which was 20 years ago. and then add the section of the young boy in 9/11. And I got a hold of the mother, because on the forum, when you put something on the forum, that's copyrighted. That's yours. You know, they can't, they don't have the right to do anything with it. Same thing for the mother. So all the stuff she wrote, all the stuff I did, I took all that. So in the book, we have the combination back and forth of all the things that transpired on the making of that story, and then plus the all the stuff that was private to the two of us. Because the mother, I wasn't going to do too much on the story. I wasn't going to get into too many details with it. I just asked her, I wanted to ask her if I could use some of the things. She said, Jeff, I think it's time that we put the story out there. So on the 20th anniversary, I put the book out there, and it's all in the book.
And I think that's excellent, because it gives anyone who's interested in this a way of, especially dealing with the child who's a three-year-old and going back in and asking just, right, you know, innocuously, did they call you Lou? Or, you know, the way that you suggested that that would be introduced, because for one thing, he would only go so far with, oh, I don't want to talk about that. Or he would just stop talking. He would start, go for a while, be fluid, and then done. And there was no way to get anything else out of him.
Kids do that. They shut down. I pulled the trick on my one of my granddaughters one time. If you could catch them off guard, she came running in the house. She was sent in to get her sneakers, put her sneakers on, because she's running around outside with her socks and messing her socks up or whatever. So I saw her outside sitting on a little wall, and she's struggling with the sneakers. So I went out, and I bent down. I said, you need some help with that? Okay. So I was helping her put the sneakers on. I said, did you used to be able to put your shoes on when you were big? And I looked at her, and she just looked up at the sky a little bit, like a distant gaze. And she says, yes, but they were different. And she started describing high-top shoes and putting them on with button hooks.
Yeah.
Okay?
Yeah.
So you can catch the little devils once in a while. I sent the mother out in California. I sent her a picture of the lieutenant. And she dropped it in next to her son one time. He was sitting on the couch. And he looked at it. He said, where'd you get that? That's not a good picture, he said.
My stepsister told my grandmother when she was little, and she must have been, you know, again, like three or four, she came up to her and she said, I used to dance with you when I was a boy. And that was as far as it got. But just that little thing of remembering, and, you know, there was nowhere to go from there. But it was one of those reminders that we have memories until we get a little older and start becoming more socialized and indoctrinated into how we're supposed to act in this reality. And some of those, that's what you said. You didn't remember this until you were on that battlefield. And the thing about this that's in common with the boys, when he went to the place where the former life had happened, then he got anxiety, he got headaches, anxiety.
Well, yeah, as time went by, when he was little, it was amazing his concern over the people he couldn't get to in 9/11, and the people jumping and all that they wouldn't wait for him. I told his mother to tell him not that they wouldn't wait, they couldn't wait. So,
yeah.
But he was little then. He's much bigger now. He's 6 feet tall, 195 pounds, athletic, and I tell the girls he's got a smile that'd melt your heart. But when he was 13 years old, his parents went to Manhattan, and they went down to Trade Center, and they have that museum that's underground, and the museum has a very large vehicle there. It's ladder 3. That's the rig that the lieutenant was assigned to. They did okay up when they were above grade there, you know, the memorial pools and things like that. They went down. They're going through the museum, and when they got to ladder 3, he wanted out of there. He told his mother he's very claustrophobic and he wanted to get out of there. They even asked the staff there for assistance to get them out as the fastest way they could. So similar to what happened to me in the sunken road, walked into that, I guess you call it a harmonic resonance. There's something abides still there. Well, imagine walking up to a vehicle that you were assigned to during 9/11.
There are a lot of stories, ghost stories, hauntings about the battlefields and about places like that where there's been a lot of loss of life. Have you ever experienced, can you address that? Have you experienced anything like that? Or from your perspective, how does that play out?
I had a similar thing happen with that he had done with the ladder three, though, but it was in Harper's Ferry. I walked into a building there, and I went up on the second floor, and I came back down and shot past my wife. I said, I'm going outside. I couldn't stay there. I don't know what it was, but Spotsylvania Courthouse, the battle that was fought there, was a horrendous battle. There was one portion of the battlefield. There was hand-to-hand combat for 11 hours, okay? Hand-to-hand for 11 hours straight. So that was in the Muleshoe Salient, and Gordon had been back farther with his men during the night, and one of the sentries came to him and said that they heard talking and stuff up at the tip of the Muleshoe. And he got his guys together, and the Union soldiers had gotten into the Muleshoe, and they helped push him back. I went to, there's very few battlefields that are pretty much like they were when the battles happened. Antietam's a very beautiful battlefield, and it's pretty much pristine and pretty much the way it was in battle. The little battlefield of Spotsylvania is the same way. In the Muleshoe, there was a tree that was 24 inches in diameter near the trenches where the Confederates were. It was taken down. It was cut in half by musketry. That's how many bullets were flying around.
Wow.
I went and visited that. There's no visitor center or anything. You're on your own, and walked around, and I just realized, remembering all the stuff that happened there, and I wanted to bring something home with me. I wanted to find something. I was looking around. I was going to pick up a stone and bring it home, if I had to, just to have a memento from the battlefield. So while I'm standing there, there was like a flash off to my right, about eye level. And I looked over that way again and did it again. So I started walking over toward where I saw it, and it was a knot in a tree. And I was picking at it a little bit. I said, wait a minute, this tree isn't even big enough to have been here when the battle was, fought and all, And now here's how my mind used to work, logical mind. It had just finished raining earlier. There was water in the knot hole, and the sun must have shined off that water and it blinked, because it did it like three times before I got to it. Mm. And I said, I guess I'm not going to find anything. And I looked down at the ground, and about an inch off the toe of my right shoe, there was a brown spot about the size of a quarter. And I leaned over, I looked at it, cleared it off and picked it up, and it was like a quarter of a cannonball.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah, I had a little help.
Also, when I got home, my theory with the sun shining on that knot hole and flash and all that, the pictures, it was overcast. There was no sun.
Blew that one away, huh?
Yeah.
But that's what we try to do. We try to figure out, okay, logically, is there a reason? Before you jump to conclusions, you try and figure out, could there be another source for what I'm experiencing?
I got to the point where I started laughing at everything. I was being pushed around. I tell people I was being pushed around like a sharp shopping cart. I was being led all over. I was taking my mother back down home, and I wanted to swing by Atlanta. And go to the main library, because I had read that there was a book that was written that said that the only existing copy of a boyhood sketch that Gordon had done for Youth Companion magazine was at the main library in Atlanta. So I went in, and I love the reference people, the research people and all that, that I was talking to this lady and explaining what I was looking for, and she was looking in the computer and all. I don't see where we have that and all. And she said, you know, well, things were changed around back in 1930 and all that. I said, the book I read that said that you have the copy was written in 1955. Well, there's other reference people coming around. They're listening to the story. It is sort of like a knights on a quest. They took off. They disappeared. About 20 minutes later, the woman came back, the first original woman. She's got papers in her hand. She says, look what I've got. She said, you're not going to believe this. She said, we found it in a room that has been locked for eons, and we just got the key for that room this morning. And I looked at her and I said, you got that key because I was coming.
Yeah. With all of this, you obviously know why you're here. I like the poems that you include in your book. What is the message?
Oh my, there's just so many reasons. It's not just one thing. Living a life here is the journey, the life itself. It's a mixture. Some people get bad because you say it's like a schoolroom and you're here to learn lessons, and they keep getting upset because it seems they have lifetimes where they come back and they're here and they get pummeled around and all. I believe we all come from the same source. Now, if you want to call that source God, Frank, whatever name you want to give, we all come from that source. And I refer to that source as God. And I refer to us as gods. Put a small g on it, but we're actually gods here too, because if you think about it, it all depends on your intent. If you get up in the morning and you want to do good and go out and help people, you do that. If you want to do bad, you go out and rob a bank, so on. So we have that free will, which a lot of times messes us up. But there's not one reason for all of this. It's a mixture of things. We're here to experience. We being a portion of God are sort of like the experiencing portion of God, because he's pretty much got to stay where he is and handle things, okay? So we may be down here to learn something for ourselves. We may be down here to help somebody else that, like, we owe a favor to, that somebody may have done a favor for us before and so on. To come across somebody, some place, something in your lifetime that triggers you, like Antietam did,
yeah,
and set me on a certain path. You know, you can get off the path. That we have great input into the script that we're living here, and there's paths we can follow, but you can get off the path, and sometimes you need help getting back on. It's hard. People want a pat answer, and there's no pat answer. But if you think about it, you think about your own life. You're a student. You're a teacher. You're a healer. You're many different things, and then you're different things to different people. You could be a father to one person, an uncle to another, so on. It's not simple, and a lot of times it's not easy. But many of the people that have very successful lives and a lot of people that went through trials and tribulations and so on, you know, they got run over by a car and they were in the hospital for 2 months. And you say, oh, that was horrible. And they say, no, that was the best thing that ever happened to me, because I finally had to slow down. I finally had to take stock of myself and so on. So it's very hard to tell what is good or bad. But I think the main thing is we're trying to pretty much to get back to our starting point and, you know, go full circle. But there's a lot of adventures along the way, and this isn't the only place we go. And yes, there's many more dimensions, and, you know, people want another thing. People want a pat answer. What's it like between lives? You know, well, it all could depend on your experience, where you go and end up and who you're with. And I guess one of the rules that seems to apply is like attracts like. So if you weren't too pleasant, you know, people actually make their own hell. You could end up in a place that where you're exactly like the person, the other people that are there. And I guess that would kind of drive you a little nuts. But there's also a lot of beautiful places, and the mind's the builder. If you ever watched the movie Robin Williams, What Dreams May Come.
Yeah.
He goes to heaven and he finally catches on how things work, and you build with your mind, and he finally gets things so he can pick them up, and they aren't all mushy. They're solid to him, though, and has a house and all that. Now, his wife, who was left behind after he died and their two children died, just went into a big slump, extremely depressed, killed herself, and ended up going to hell. Well, the hell she was in was a hell that she put herself in. And then the story is he goes to get her back. A lot of the things in that movie, he was talking to his two children that had died, and he didn't realize it because they had taken on other forms. It's just like we're all different vibrations. I will retain the same vibration when I'm on the other side that I had in all the other lifetimes here. But if people from those time periods call up that vibration, they might see me as like Gordon, whereas a person, if they passed from, I was already on the other side, they passed from this lifetime, would see that vibration as me today. So it all depends on where you're coming from. So it gets, it's a big story.
Yeah, it's much more complicated, complex, intricate, and fascinating.
If you think about it, though, it's really not complicated. It's simple, but you're seeing things, other people are seeing things from all different viewpoints. You would recognize this other vibration as somebody, you know, that you do in this, and so on and so on. So if you wanted to connect with somebody else, you don't need a telephone or anything. You just sort of like dial up their vibration. That's one thing that's faster than the speed of light is thought. My wife showed up at the firehouse one morning when I was still in bed, and I usually could sleep pretty well when I was at the firehouse, as long as we were not on the calls. But that night I was rolling all around, and I rolled over and I see my wife stand there. I said, "My father passed away." She said, "Yeah." Now, that seems that I had some sort of connection with my father. Better than that was, she said my sister had called. My sister lived in Georgia. Like I told you before, my mother moved up with her. My parents were down in Florida. My sister woke up at 4 o'clock in the morning and was so upset about my father. She called down to my mother and asked how my father was. And she said, my mother said, "They're putting him in the ambulance right now." So we're all connected.
For the book, and this is the most recent version, Fire in the Soul, for people who want the Cliff Notes, if they go to your website, you can do, well, there's also the other Reincarnation Research. Reincarnation Research is Walter Simkew's website, and that has kind of the Cliff Note, the shorter version of all of your story, which I think is fascinating. And then on your website, at the bottom of the page, you've got the video there from the Proof Positive.
Go to my homepage and there's a video of the little 9/11 boy that was very well done. I don't know who did it, but they did a great job on it. Down the bottom of the page is the Proof Positive program. And then there's a media page with podcasts and links and books and, you know, probably more than you ever cared to know about anybody.
Oh, I think it's fantastic. I love the connection with the Civil War. And then with 9/11, with the firefighters, the Confederate general and Connecticut Yankee, A Past Life Revealed. That's been on multiple venues, Sci-Fi Channel, Biography, PBS. So your story's out there. I'm glad you're still talking about it, because I think some people are just now coming to this, whether they've had a past life memory or know somebody who has, and you've got a lot of answers, or at least some suggestions and some helpful information.
I try to help. That's one of the reasons why I'm here. I'm supposed to be doing that. I've found some other hints in other lifetimes, and there seems to be a common thread that runs through them. You know, they'll be like a warrior that could be with a weapon or without a weapon. It depends on what you're fighting for. Seems I've been a reuniter through a lot of different lifetimes. So I think we need that. That's what I'm doing here now, trying to, you know, maybe get some peace going in the world, because if I had a in Japan and Scotland, if two Native American tribes, and all I've been a lot. Oh, and a girl, Peggy, in Ireland. So now,
yes,
different genders and different skin tones and so on. So that tells me we are raceless. Imagine that. What would happen in the world if we found out they were raceless? That there were more spirit than human.
And we might be nicer.
even if they just went along with it and believed it. You know?
Yeah. Thank you. I appreciate your time. I really enjoyed reading your book. like you said, it isn't complex, it's simple. It's just challenging for us to do all the connecting with all of these lifetimes and how they relate to the present moment, because this is where it's really happening right now.
Yeah, and I'm trying to do the best I can because I turned 75 last September, and as like I said in my book, I can see the clock on the wall with the hands moving by like a cat licking its face, and I don't know how much longer I'm going to be around, but I'll keep talking, I guess, until they keep shoveling the dirt on me.
Again, Jeffrey Keen, the book Fire in the Soul, website, jeffreykeen.com. There's so much going into the background of Jeffrey's story. We don't have time to get into all of that. And again, multiple shows that he's done have videos available at YouTube, on the web. You can find them. Also some links on his website. I'll put links in the description for the show. This is one of those slam dunk reincarnation stories with pictures and documented evidence, the connections between the person that he remembers being and then the other incidentals that come along the way as he remembers additional past lives. Thanks for listening.